that has done so much to support President Guaido, to organize aid for their compatriots, and to do just a lot back home. Thank you very much for being here.
And that is President Trump on Monday, part of the speech that he gave on Venezuela in Miami. A lot of the Venezuelan immigrants to the U.S. were present. Lucas, how exactly is he using Venezuelan immigrants to the United States? He's basically admitted very clearly that it was this community that helped organize the aid to their compatriots back home. But of course, the aid is a thinly veiled pretext for some sort of U.S. intervention, right?
Yeah, I don't think that the Venezuelan community in the United States is at all involved in this effort. Rather, it is, you know, as we saw on Saturday, it is being carried out completely by the U.S. military and U.S. military jets, which on Saturday landed this so-called humanitarian aid in Cúcuta, just 8 kilometers from the Venezuelan border. And really, we have to understand that the International Red Cross, the United Nations, Oxfam, and numerous other international humanitarian bodies have criticized in no uncertain terms this aid effort as politicized, as, you know, an effort to use aid as an instrument for toppling a government which the United States doesn't like, which, you know, of course, is a violation of all of the principles that govern the distribution of humanitarian aid. And moreover, we shouldn't forget that it is Mr. Elliot Abrams who, in the Reagan administration, was key in channeling U.S. weapons, using humanitarian planes earmarked for humanitarian purposes to channel weapons to the Contra paramilitaries in Nicaragua, you know, during the United States' illegal war there. And also, of course, he was supplying weapons to the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala as well. And he is now resurrected as the U.S. envoy to Venezuela now. So we should be very wary of the U.S. effort to bring this so-called aid into Venezuela in violation of Venezuelan sovereignty. And also remember that Venezuela, that Maduro did asked for and received humanitarian aid from the United Nations in November and from other international bodies. The issue is not about the aid, it's the issue of who is bringing the aid and with what agenda.
Right, and I'm glad you brought up Elliot Abrams, the U.S. Special Envoy to Venezuela, who in the U.S. Congress seems to have been challenged only by freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar last week. He got very defensive when she brought up his role in some of those Latin American countries that you were referring to. Back to the aid, I mean, it's so important to put it into context, right? Because here in the U.S., what we're getting in media coverage is Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro is standing in the way of his desperate, hungry people being able to get aid, that he is purposefully preventing them from having access to aid. And they don't seem to be characterizing how the aid is so politicized. A sovereign, you know, why would a sovereign country accept aid from another nation that's so openly planning on, you know, changing their regime in that country? No country would ever allow aid from such a giver. And so it seems to be a very obvious political stunt intended to basically challenge Maduro, right?
Indeed, and we have to remember that it's also USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is delivering the aid. And USAID has played a very nefarious role in many countries, supporting, in Venezuela, for example, financing the tune of something like $50 to $60 million a year to Venezuelan opposition in its efforts to topple the government through NGO organizations, et cetera, and, you know, in many other countries as well. And obviously, if this were occurring, if a Russian agency were doing the same thing to NGOs in the United States, I mean, it would be a national scandal. But in Venezuela, this is, of course, completely tolerated and normal. And moreover, we should remember that this is $20 million of aid the United States has pledged. Meanwhile, a few weeks ago, John Bolton unveiled the latest escalation of U.S. sanctions in the country, a de facto oil embargo, which is going to cost Venezuela $11 billion in lost oil revenues this year. That's equivalent to $30 million a day. You know, meanwhile, I mean, this is going to have very, very detrimental consequences for the Venezuelan people, the economy, and society. You know, Francisco Rodriguez, who is arguably the foremost expert in the Venezuelan economy and who was an advisor to opposition presidential candidate Henry Falcon, he has predicted that as a result of this oil embargo and also the previous financial sanctions that were implemented in August 2017, Venezuela's economy is going to contract by over a quarter, by 26% in 2019. And, you know, evidently, the people of Venezuela are going to pay the price for, you know, this economic siege which is being imposed in the country, just like the Iraqi people paid the price in the 1990s when 500,000 children died as a result of the U.S. embargo there. When Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Secretary of State, was asked about it, if the price was worth it, if so many children died for the United States to topple Saddam, and she replied, yes, the price is worth it. So we must ask the policymakers in Washington, is the price worth it in Venezuela at this time?
And so you're saying that the economic sanctions have against Venezuela imposed by the U.S. have played a much bigger role in destabilizing the Venezuelan economy than we really hear about here in the U.S.?
Indeed. In fact, as a result of this, the financial blockade, which was imposed by Trump, basically in August of 2017, when the Treasury Department prohibited U.S. financial entities or financial entities operating in the United States from engaging in lending to the Venezuelan state and its state oil company. And this, you know, basically this denying Venezuela access to the global credit market, preventing it from refinancing its debt, you know, this cost Venezuela an estimated $1 billion in the 12 months subsequent to that. And, you know, Francisco Rodriguez, again, an opposition economist, has, you know, argued that this was played a pivotal role in the collapse of Venezuela's oil industry. It was a source of over 90% of all its export revenue, and the production fell by over a million barrels a day in that period. So, I mean, this is playing a huge role, you know, just in that period. As a result of those sanctions alone, Venezuela lost around 6% a year in GDP. Just to give you perspective, healthcare spending in Latin America averages around 7% of GDP. So these sanctions, you know, as the U.S.'s own Congressional Research Service said in November in its own study, that that further economic sanctions will, quote unquote, exacerbate the difficult humanitarian situation in the country. The United States government is fully aware of what it is doing, that is attempting to make conditions in the country so unbearable that the government will fall. And of course, this is illegal under international law, U.S. law, you know, because this is not a national, it is not a United States, and, you know, a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment of a country.
I want to talk about how the Trump administration is also invoking Cuba. What do you make of the fact that in his speech, Trump referred to Cuba 18 times and linked Venezuela and Cuba? And certainly Cuba has expressed a lot of solidarity. The president, Díaz-Canel has expressed overt solidarity with Venezuela, but it seems as though the U.S. is happy about casting Venezuela and Cuba as part of the same team.
Indeed, Trump and his administration have been very explicit that this is a kind of domino strategy that they're pursuing here, that they want to topple the Maduro government in Caracas, and then they want to proceed to Havana and, you know, finally realize the, you know, 60-plus U.S. U.S. policy of seeking to overthrow the government, the socialist government in Cuba, and then afterwards they want to proceed to topple the Ortega government in Nicaragua. You know, clearly, this is a long-established U.S. regime change policy, and, you know, it's attempting to really overthrow the last of the governments in the region that have stood up to U.S. dictates and have sought to chart a sovereign and independent course, both in their own countries and the region, attempting to build an alternative political, economic integration bodies. For example, the UNASUR, which is the Union of South American Nations, the CELAC, which is basically all 34 countries in the, all 35 countries in the hemisphere, minus the United States, and Canada as a mechanism of integration, the Petrocaribe, the ALBA, all of these bodies, all of these organizations that have really challenged the United States' imperial hegemony in the region. And for this very reason, the United States is definitely seeking to topple all of these governments, and Cuba evidently the most emblematic, you know, with the historical legacy of the Cuban Revolution and what it meant for the Cuban people and the people of the hemisphere. And, you know, in Venezuela, of course, there's all this discourse that Cuba is occupying, you know, Venezuela, which is, you know, utterly ridiculous. I mean, given that, you know, the Cuban doctors who, you know, serve in many medical clinics in the poorest parts of Venezuela are, you know, welcomed by the people there and are identified as, you know, part of an international solidarity, you know, mission, as opposed to some kind of occupying force. I mean, evidently it's a very, you know, callous effort to dissimulate the United States' own, you know, imperial efforts within the country.
Now, Lucas, what about the fact that Maduro is sort of still struggling to hold on to power within Venezuela? What is the sentiment inside Venezuela regarding Maduro? Do you see a strengthening of his base in the face of U.S. threats, that people are sort of realizing that they would rather solve their own internal problems instead of having the U.S. Foisted on them through outside intervention? There are, I understand, pro-Maduro rallies that have been held that we just aren't hearing much about in the U.S.
I think you're definitely seeing a certain closing of ranks within Chavismo, within the Chavista political movement, you know, behind the government, behind Maduro, against this effort to this coup d'etat that the United States is pushing in the country. You know, we have to remember that 6.2 million Venezuelans voted for Nicolas Maduro as president on May 20th, 2018. And you can, you know, that's 31% of Venezuela's total electorate or voting eligible population. You know, compare that, you know, that's pretty much standard, you know, for U.S. presidents. And Donald Trump won with 26% of the U.S. electorate, Obama with 31% in 2008, and a little bit less in 2012. So the idea that Maduro doesn't have, you know, a certain level of popular support or legitimacy is false, despite, you know, certainly, yes, he is deeply unpopular for his inability to resolve the economic crisis. But we should understand that among a large section of Venezuela's population, not just those 6 million people, but many more people who may not support Mr. Maduro, President Maduro, but they definitely oppose the U.S. and its local opposition proxies' efforts to overthrow the government. They reject that and therefore are willing to, you know, back the government against those efforts, to defeat those efforts. Anyway, when you go to study the popular sectors in Caracas, and you see more Chavista paraphernalia than you saw before. I mean, there definitely is a real, I think, instinctual understanding among the Chavista masses, the base, the social basis of this process, that the U.S. and opposition agenda is to topple the government and to literally wipe Chavismo from the political map, seek to, you know, effectively wait. There's a real danger that the opposition seeks to wage a certain kind of dirty war, you know, hunt, you know, of the kind that we saw in Central America under Elliot Abrams in the 1980s, or in the Southern Cone in the 1970s, you know, of trying to uproot Chavismo, you know, persecute Chavista activists, political activists, social leaders of all community leaders of all kinds. So there really is an understanding that this is an existential threat that is posed by the United States in this moment.
Has Maduro made mistakes that Chavez avoided?
It's very complex because Maduro inherited the economy as Chavez inherited it, and the country as it was at that time. And, you know, there was a lot of problems, particularly with the issue of, for example, the exchange, that we have an overvalued exchange rate that, you know, as a result of the maintenance of a regime of exchange controls, which led to all kinds of distortions in the Venezuelan economy, with things being imported very cheaply, but then, you know, this opened a way for dollars allocated to the state to be resold in the black market, and it has a very, you know, it has created a very toxic kind of logic that Maduro, unfortunately, you know, he inherited, and he has not succeeded or, you know, in overcoming. He has not made the kinds of important economic reforms that, you know, could have perhaps in 2014, maybe even beginning of 2015, led, open the way for economic recovery. You know, among those, like, you know, liberating the exchange controls and, you know, implementing a policy of direct subsidies as opposed to indirect subsidies, et cetera. Nonetheless, it's important to recognize that the United States, from the very beginning that Maduro came into office, you know, the U.S. refused to recognize his electoral victory, which is recognized by every other government in the world. The opposition, like, took to the streets. 8 people were killed. The medical clinics, many of them were staffed by Cuban doctors, were firebombed. You know, 2014, the opposition again took to the streets to get, trying to oust the president, who in that time, you know, they questioned Maduro's legitimacy. Now, at the United States and, you know, the opposition was
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Coming up, we will have Free Culture Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, Demilitarizing the Pacific, on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House in Portland. Demilitarizing the Pacific features three indigenous women speaking on the destruction of a coral reef to expand a military base in Japan, curbing military buildup in Guam, and peace and justice in Hawaii. Again, that's Demilitarizing the Pacific on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House, 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Trillium Public Charter School in North Portland. Enrollment for the 2019-2020 school year is now open for students K through 12 with an open house on February 21st at 6:30 p.m. More information online at trilliumcharterschool.org. It's about a quarter past six, and in a bit we will have Free Culture Radio coming up.
Found a flat. After that, we got married. Working hard for the dream. Scoring goals for the other team. Times were bad. We were glad we got married. I love the way you open up your arms to each other. When you find a meeting of the minds, just as well, love was all we ever wanted. It was all we ever had. Further on in the game, waiting up till the children came. It's no regrets. We got married. We got married. We got married, we
Roasting 200 years of corporate constitutional rights, 1819 to 2019, notes the anniversary of the first U.S. Supreme Court decision granting constitutional rights to business corporations. The event features a photography exhibit, trivia, conversation, and presentations about how we can reclaim people's constitutional rights and dismantle corporate rights. Again, that's Roasting 200 Years of Corporate Constitutional Rights on Thursday, February 28th, from 6 to 9 p.m. This is a drop-in event happening at the Just Bob Cafe, 2403 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell. What did jazz artists Christian Scott Atunde Adjua, Pharoah Sanders, Steve Turay, Terrence Blanchard, and Marcus Strickland have in common? One, they are all performing at this year's PDX Jazz Festival. And two, they have all been featured on my program, Jazz in the New Millennium. Each one-hour episode focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective. The weekly show is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on audio, then podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. For the convenience of those who might be interested in attending one or more of these concerts, we have grouped the PDX jazz artists together into a special mini-season. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. In honor of Engineers Week, Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering features a panel of 6 local women of color engineers talking about their career paths and answering questions. The panel is moderated by Cheryl Norris. Again, that's Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Timothy Leary lives. No, he's outside looking in. Timothy Leary lives. No, he's outside.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio.